When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your daily podcast for the biggest storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Saturday, April 20th. We have so much to catch up on today's podcast. It's been more than a week since we've published an episode here on this feed. Of course, that's not because there's been a lack of entertaining results or intriguing things for us to discuss from the pro tennis world. No, it's because we've been otherwise busy here at Crack Rackets broadcasting first ball to last coverage of these 2024 Big 12 Tennis Championships. Of course, that coverage continues both today here on Saturday and then with Championship Sunday tomorrow. So if you, like me, are enthralled by everything happening in the college tennis world, come watch our coverage of all things Big 12 tournament over on ESPN+. That said, I am well aware we have a lot to discuss here on today's podcast as, again, we try to play catch-up on everything that's unfolded over the last week in the tennis world. I mean, we've had 1,000-level events on both the men's and women's side. That's not true. Stuttgart's a 500. I think I make that mistake every season, but that's how you know we are back in the thick of the clay court swing. And again, now we have seen just about all of the top players in the world compete at least once on this surface. Thus, let's offer some reflections. Let's take a look at everything that's unfolded here thus far. We're going to go in reverse order, starting with Stuttgart, then covering all things Monte Carlo. And I could think of no better guest to help me do precisely that here on today's show than the man who will be joining me to help break it all down. Of course, I would argue there's no person in the tennis world who's watched more of these past two events unfold, as of course he has been responsible for covering all aspects of it over on tennis.com. Of course, we all know him best here as a returning champion on this podcast, essentially my co-host of the Mini Break, lead editor for all things tennis.com, DKTNNS on Twitter. It's our dear friend, David Kang, joining us once again. DK, welcome back to the show. You have been on the beat, my friend, of late. How's it been? Are you enjoying this transition to the clay court swing?
Gruskin, I am fresh out the slammer, coming to you live from the Tortured Poets Department. My boy Gruskin, my boy breaks only his favorite toys, but Daddy, I love him. This all song lyrics, song titles from the latest Taylor Swift double album that I've been immersed in when I'm not consuming all things Monte Carlo and Stuttgart. So I'm very excited to talk to an actual person and discuss all of them with you.
See, you go Taylor Swift, I go old school. I think I stopped learning new music lyrics after 2015-ish. So I don't want to live that way, DK, reading into every word you say. You said that you could let it go, and I wouldn't catch you hung up on somebody that you used to know, but you didn't have to cut me off. Anyways, is that
what happened to Kimbra? I miss Kimbra. Yeah.
Well, Gautier was a one-hit wonder. Like, yes. The most thorough. Were they the last one-hit wonder? Some scholars argue maybe. We can look through that. I mean, definitely not is the answer to that question. But
I guess depending on which language chart you would place the singers of Despacito. I mean, I don't know a second Despacito song.
Is that even an artist? I thought that was like a
no. It's
DJ.
Like Louis.
Yeah,
Louis
exactly.
Fonte,
yeah. But I don't even think that counts. That's hilarious.
But coming from suburbia, it's the Despacito man.
That's actually a really good call by you. I like that. That's funny. I would say Gym Class Heroes were almost on that list because you know they had. I don't know. I don't know. What
take
is
a look at my girlfriend.
Yeah, exactly. But then they also had
the only
chokehold. So I was like, they're actually a two-hit wonder. Yeah, that's good. Anyways, there's your late 2000s, early 2010s pop catch-up for all of you listeners. But again, truth be told, I'd have redone that intro. I didn't love it, but we're on a bit of a time crunch here, and we have so much tennis to discuss on today's show. So DK, let's get into it. As I alluded to, I want to go in reverse order because here on Saturday, we're recording this 12:28 p.m. Central Time, which is the time zone I am currently in here in Stillwater. The reason I bring that up, We saw Iga Swiatek lose her first match on clay of the season here this morning. Now, again, it was a tightly competitive match, certainly a three-setter, ultimately going the way of Elena Rybakina. And, you know, again, DK, let's get right into it. We've talked a lot about Rybakina here through this first third of the season. It does feel like when she's healthy, again, she has played as well as anyone we've seen throughout the course of this year. Today, a 6-3-4-6-6-3 victory over the world number one. She's into another final. You add this, obviously, to her run to the Miami final, her run in week number one of the season as well. I'll get the number up here in a moment, but I think it's something like 25-3 or something crazy like that overall now on this season. 25-4, excuse me. I've forgotten about the Paolini or not the Paolini loss, about the Alexandrova loss in Adelaide. Still, 25-4, the win over Iga on clay. I know it's indoor clay, so it hits a little bit differently. But, I mean, again, when she has been healthy this year, she's playing Tier 1 tennis, DK.
I mean, first I will say I am glad we waited to record this podcast until after the match, because I feel like the last two times we have done a really exuberant, over-the-top hyping of Iga Swiatek's chances. She has proceeded to lose her next match, both to Kalinskaya in Dubai and to Alexandrova in Miami. So you can't blame us for this one. That said, I do think that coming into this match, there was certainly a more of a shot that this was going to be more complicated for Swiatek. I think Rybakina at this point, given the ups and downs from Aryna Sabalenka, Rybakina has become the primary top tier, I should specify, rival to Swiatek, because she can do all of the things that still, as much as Swiatek has managed to plug up some of the not weaknesses, but elements of her game that can make her susceptible to this kind of player, she is still ultimately susceptible. That'll always be probably the go-to player, the player archetype that will make things most difficult. I'm trying to be as very precise as possible when I describe this, because I don't want to say that she's bad against big hitters, but I think that the way that Rybakina plays is heavy hitting, consistent, and it just makes life more difficult for Iga.
Can I do-si-do in for you here?
By all means.
Thank you. It has nothing to do with Iga's weaknesses. It has everything to do with Rybakina's strength. If you are going to beat Iga, you have to be able to play on your terms. You have to almost be able to say, I don't care what's going on that other side of the net. If I execute my game, it's going to be able to keep me in the fight. And as we have alluded to all season long, there's maybe three people in the world you'd say that about confidently. Sabalenka, obviously, when she's at her best, particularly at a major. I think there is just, I would always throw Ostapenko on that list, because she has that fearlessness aspect you need, and obviously that U.S. Open result sticks in all of our minds. But you have to respect Rybakina on that list now as well. It's the way she's played Iga in their three matchups over the last 52 weeks. And by the way, she's 2-1 against Iga during that stretch. She's 4-2 overall against Iga, 4-1 since the start of last season. It's five matches. That is not a significant sample size, but it ain't nothing either.
DK, and when it was a retirement, we should be perfectly clear.
Very, very clear, Rome. Of course, absolutely. But fine, we'll take that away. She's 3-1 against Iga since the start of last season. Does anyone else have a winning record against Iga since the start of last season? Maybe.
Well, Ostapenko.
Yeah, I was going to say, other than Ostapenko, who we've already mentioned on this list, it's just you have to have that fearlessness. You have to have those weapons, that ability to execute those weapons, even under pressure, even under against the pace that Iga throws at you. And it's just unequivocal that the 24-year-old Rybakina is able to do precisely that. The combination of size, power, strength. And then the thing I will continue to point out, DK, for someone her height, for someone who, given the robotic, rigid nature of her game, like, I think that's fair to say, the way she takes the ground stroke, it's not this peak fluidity. It's pretty just backswing, compact, swing through, over shoulder, drive through, right? It's not like this fluid motion. It's not this, you know, this poetic art or whatever of like what you imagine.
Rybakina.
Yeah, the maestro swinging a racket there. It's not the Federer grace is always the name you'd point to. Like, that's not Rybakina. It's a little bit more mechanical than that. But she is so fluid as a mover at that size, with that strength, with that speed. And I don't think, is she Iga quick? No. But she's not slow. And I think, you know, in contrasting her to big hitters past, what makes her and Sabalenka so special is that they have that improved and increased fluidity as well. And just like in this match in particular, because Rybakina is able to get out to the outer thirds, the fact that Świątek's ball is sitting shoulder height, like, that doesn't bother Rybakina because her feet are there. She's not reaching for it. And because of that, now she just gets to swing down on things. And again, watching her play line drive tennis in this match, watching, again, her do... Here's the thing. Like, she beat Iga and Sabalenka this season, and in both matches, she just straight up out-executed them. Like, she was the better player. And there's no one else in the world you would say that about. And I remember, you know, coming out of the first third, I did my top eight WTA rankings with Jeff Sackman. I felt like I was cheating on you in the moment, let the record show. But now we have you back here today. So at least I made amends for it, DK. I'm honest with you.
Your brief flirtation with AI.
Yeah.
we all got to make that pivot sooner or later.
It happens to all of us white men in this era, DK. But the more broadly, again, she's tier one. Like, it's just undeniable at this point. 25-4, 4-2 against Iga overall. Again, 3-1 if you want to disclude the Indian Wells withdrawal since the start of last season. That's tier one stuff. It's just, it's not about disrespecting, or it's not about discussing what Świątek did wrong in today's match. To me, it's always just, what did Rybakina do right? And she took the racket out of Świątek's hand.
Yeah, I think what we need to make clear, especially with WTA tennis over the last two decades or so, that it can be very matchup-based. There are just some matchups that, for as good as you can be in every other aspect of the game, there's sometimes just going to be an uncomfortable opponent, and it'll be up to you to try to figure out to solve things. But
the most
also
notable example, Sharapova versus Serena. Like, it just, it didn't work.
But there's a lot of those in tennis. Like, I think, like, Radvanska Lina, like Stozer. You know, like, there are like a lot of like these weird head-to-heads where it's like 7-0, 4-0. But you would look at that and you'd think, oh, it should be so much more even. Obviously, yes, Maria Serena is the most stark. And also because they played such similar tennis, you would have expected it to be more even. Mm-hmm. But the contrast in Świątek and Rybakina styles really lends itself to Rybakina at this point. And even though she did win Wimbledon, I do think there's an argument to be made that Rybakina is one of those flat-hitting power players who can really do a lot of damage on clay. I mean, over the years, yes, we think of clay as being something that would favor an Arantxa Sánchez Vicario or a more defensive-minded player, or Francesca Schiavone with a lot of spin. But I mean, Anna Ivanovic, Maria Sharapova, Serena Williams, you know, it's part of why I always feel like clay is still an undiscovered frontier for Naomi Osaka. Just someone with that level of pace to hit through the slow conditions. And I do feel like, based on how long these matches have been going in Stuttgart, that the court has been playing slow. I don't know what else explains the 2+ hour matches. Even the straight set match between Świątek and Raducanu went over 2 hours. I think there is a certain slowness to the conditions that I think probably should have favored, or at least even things out for Świątek. But the way that Rybakina has been able to play this week, you know, digging out of the second set hiccup against Jasmine Paolini, coming in feeling confident, feeling healthy. And Sakari mentioned that in Indian Wells, Maria Sakkari, that a lot of the difficulties in playing Iga is that when you're not at your freshest, it's like she's so fresh because she's been so efficient over the course of a week. And even though Rybakina has had to play some long matches, she has that power to make up for that perhaps maybe lack of freshness, and just makes it, a very difficult matchup for her.
Career win percentage for Rybakina, 70% in tour level matches. She's won 68% of her 208 hard court matches. She's now won 71%, DK, of her 73, a significant sample size, 73 clay court matches, 52-21 overall at the tour level on the surface. That flat power tennis transcends surface. You're absolutely right for Rybakina. And you mentioned that the Stuttgart court, I did a lot of binge watching over the last 24 hours in preparation for you coming on the show here, DK. And yes, the conditions are a little slower, but it's still indoor tennis. And the contact points are just that much cleaner indoors. I don't care what the speed of the court is. You control the serve that much more easily. The forehand is just...
Tell that to Sabalenka.
we'll get there. But again, like, it's just when you're in rhythm, indoor tennis is the easiest tennis you're going to play. And just unequivocally right now, Olena Rybakina is in rhythm. She's 48-13, DK, over her last 52 weeks. And, you know, I went on Tennis Channel Second Serve today. Shout out to Jeff Chisiver, Nick Monroe, Jason Goodall, Mike Haston. There's nothing I enjoy doing more than getting to work with those guys or you in tennis media. And I proposed the take to them, because I always try to come in with something hot, that is power tennis back on clay courts? That's one of my hot takes through the first 3 weeks. You look at players like Collins, Shelton, Rybakina, obviously here this week in Stuttgart. There was another Berrettini in Marrakesh. Like, there are some examples where it's like, hey, Tsitsipas in Monte Carlo. Is the plus one back on this surface? And to the point where if these players' feet are there, the technology has developed and, you know, the skill sets have developed to where plus one tennis is now just going to work everywhere. Like, that's just going to be the prevailing dominant thing. If you have those weapons, that's what's going to separate you from the rest of the pack, regardless of surface. And, like, Rybakina just has those weapons. And, you know, again, I see you smiling as if to say, actually, Alex, that's always been the case. And you've just slowly...
No.
Okay.
When I first started watching tennis, I mean, you think of like personally started with that because that's when tennis began in 2003, 2004. Amen. You think of like a Davenport, someone who would just be so, you know, flummoxed by the surface. But even then, Jennifer Roddick. Capriati won the French Open in 2001. Mary Pierce won it in 2000.
They say a guy named Pete Sampras, who is a myth, but allegedly he existed, and he was never good on the clay courts either, right? It's just like that was the knock on the power.
Remember the 1 year that Pete Sampras made the semifinals?
Yeah, that's all we ever talk about, my eyebrow 1996. Brother. Yeah, when we have a meeting of the fine tennis eyebrows, that always comes up. It's one of our first bullet points always in the meeting notes. But I feel like this season's been about consolidation. After we've gone through this, I like to think half decade, more prominently, some people would say it's probably more of an 18-month stretch, but a clear generational shift. And we're trying to sort out who's at the top of the rankings, who are the tier one players, just the you're in the draw, you can win the event caliber players out there right now. Are you ready to put Rybakina firmly in that category? Are you ready? Because we've been flirting with it, right? But it has been a discussion of like, well, her or Coco Gauff are kind of, yeah, they're in that top tier, but kind of half a tier below Swiatek or Sabalenka. I just don't even know if there's a half a tier delta anymore for Rybakina and those two. Like, I think I'm not with Coco. I'm not ready to go there with her. But with Rybakina, I think I'm ready to firmly ensconce her, and that inner duopoly now becomes a triangle.
I feel like we put her in that tier one as of Rome last year. And even though she did not play that great the last 6 months of 2023, I don't know if I was necessarily ready to take her out of it just because of her natural talent and what she's able to do on the court made me think. I mean, even, you know, she was very close to making the semifinals of Cancun at the WTA Finals last year, you know, three sets against Sabalenka. So I do think the three best players on tour in terms of just if you're previewing any draw, you give them the still a greater shot perhaps than the field, it would be Iga, Arena, and Elena in some order, you know, and then maybe a bit of a step before Coco and then the rest of the field. Like an on fire Ostapenko perhaps, but
Kostyuk.
Even that's been a bit more
come on,
wildly
now.
Consistent Marta Kostyuk.
Exactly. No, I've been so impressed by Rybakina, and look, it's funny, like the context, she played two unseeded players before Swiatek, three-set win over Kudermetova, who's been top 20 for 24 months consecutively, three-set win over Jasmine Paolini, who's in the WTA Tour race for 2024 with how she started the first third.
Dubai champion.
Yeah, top 15 player. Three-set win over Swiatek. Like, she's had to go the hard way in all of them, and yet in each of these matches, again, her ability to win free points at a rate that her opponents just can't seem to match. It's what gets her out of jams. It's what gets her out of 15-30 service game holes or 30-40 breakpoint deficits. And I also think she's hitting the return of serve better than ever before. The numbers certainly bear that out. You look at the break percentage for her here in 2024, career high 35.5% so far through, again, 29 matches of tennis. This is the best version of a player who, by the way, 24 years old, she should be ascending towards her prime. Like, a lot of this makes sense to me. I guess in my mind, I apologize for ascribing my views upon you, DK, but in my mind, there was a gap that had emerged. I thought it was a top two and everyone else coming out of the first third. And yeah, Rybakina was the closest to those top two, but given the lack of relative inconsistency, of Sabalenka, given Swiatek is still the most consistent of the field, but clearly, beatable is the wrong word, but against top-tier talent, vulnerable, I just like the gap's not there anymore. Rybakina belongs in, you shouldn't speak the other two without including her in the sentence as well. If you're talking about the best women's players in the game, and at 25-4 with wins over Swiatek and Sabalenka, where she was clearly better than both of those players in the match this season, that would be where the disrespect is to not include her on that list. And I just think I will have to moving forward.
Yeah, I think the Paolini win was important because I think, to your point, while I don't think I took her out of the top tier, I do think she was probably, and even Sabalenka at this point, is someone who is subject to a player who is riding momentum. And I felt like Paolini, the way that she's been playing the last couple of weeks, felt like, oh, this is going to just be a continued footnote on the Paolini ascension. And the fact that Rybakina was able to lose that second set, play so well in the third, it was like, okay, even though you're not playing your best and you're up against a really good, an on fire inspired opponent, you were able to win that. You know, that's what Iga does, you know, against Linda Noskova, but, you know, at Indian Wells in Miami, like a player who has a lot of momentum, a lot of confidence, was still able to figure out a way to win that match. That is a trait right now that is hard to ascribe to really anyone outside of Iga, but the fact that Elena was able to do that gives me confidence that she'll be able to continue to do it, at least through the clay swing.
Yeah, that's the big thing. Again, the numbers say, like, she's a really good player across surfaces, and of course, we've seen her make a slam final on hard courts. We now have seen her beat Iga on clay. Oh, and her slam title came on grass courts, by the way, as well. Just a little footnote to put in the back of your mind. Yeah, she's tier one. She's into the final, and she's going to match up with Marta Kostyuk, DK. Marta Kostyuk, whose run to this final looked like the following. 3 sets over Siegemund in round 1, 3 sets over Chin Wen in round number 2, of course, yesterday, 7-6 in the third. She knocked out Coco Gauff in what has been maybe my favorite rivalry of the 2024 season, in the sense of the two matches they've played have been so horrifying that there's a beauty in that horror for me. You know I love it. Again, that's just like, that's my strike zone. And then today, 6-2 over Vondrousova, a former French Open finalist.
That's just
an that's an exceptional win for Marta Kostyuk. And, you know, again, obviously the rankings reflect her rise. She's up to a new career high, number 21 right now in the live rankings. To me, the more pressing number, she's 7th right now in the points race. And again, she's the oldest 21-year-old we have in all of the sport, because it does feel like she's been around for a half decade. She is still
the oldest 21-year-old ever.
Yeah,
she's the oldest living 21-year-old.
Until Coco Gauff turns 21. And then Coco Gauff becomes the oldest living 21-year-old.
Yeah, but there's still something youth, like there's a youthful vibe.
Yeah, that's true.
I think Coco, conversely, will always sort of be a teenager.
Like, yeah, there's an innocence to Coco. Like, that's just, not that I'm saying Kostyuk doesn't have that, but there is that youthful exuberance. Not the innocence, exuberance, excuse me. That energy, that Coco, that vibe she gives off is like, yeah, we're here to have fun, which as you get older kind of wanes a bit.
Coco,
not for us.
Compartmentalize.
Okay, not a college tennis fan. Can I tell you today, a head coach, his very first quote to me today is, on my tombstone, I want it to say maturity is overrated. You're telling me you don't want to get into college tennis knowing that a head coach wants that on his tombstone?
That maturity, I think it's rated. I think it's underrated. I think it's the reason why Iga is number one right now is because
she's
the most mature player on tour. And there are like a lot of emotional, you know, head cases underneath.
Look, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that's my sort of quote. That's my energy. Maturity is overrated. That's what we're talking about here.
To be fair, if we're talking about entertainment value,
yeah,
it's perhaps a little different.
Amen. And that's what we try to do here, DK. We try to entertain. Anyways, that's all Marta Kostyuk has done this season. Obviously, the oldest 21-year-old in the world is off to the best start of her career to any given season. And again, you look at what she's just accomplished literally by the numbers here this year. Obviously, 7th in the points race, DK. That speaks for itself, and it's a deserved 7. Like, we've done this a couple of times. Try to find your top 8s right now. It's a tough exercise to do. At 18-6 with wins over Gauff, Vondrousova twice, Chin Wen, Pavlyuchenkova twice, Pegula.
Potapova.
Like, tell me that's not a top 8 resume. Like, tell me she doesn't deserve to be there. And again, like, even superficially, Aussie quarterfinals, San Diego finals, Indian Wells semis, now Stuttgart final. That's a fucking top 8 resume. Like, the breakout has happened, and I like to think we willed it. Because you and I never gave up on 21-year-old Marta Kostyuk. We said for years, this is Bianca Andreescu. It just hasn't clicked yet. The main character energy, the skill set, the athleticism, the strength. It just feels like she's finally put it all together, TK.
Like, we were at the sonogram. I feel like we've been there since birth.
My mom, noted OB-GYN, might have delivered her.
We were at the baptism.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Yeah, and it's funny because we talk about maturity. I mean, and going back to that Australian Open quarterfinal, I think that if Kostyuk hadn't incurred that kind of loss a year ago, I do think it would have really derailed her. So I think it speaks to an increased on-court maturity, a calmness, a improved bearing of mind that she was able to take that match for what it was. It was a crazy match. I still made my first Grand Slam quarterfinal. I had chances to be in a semifinal, and I'm going to channel that momentum into further success this season. And she actually mentioned something interesting that sometimes, which is like classic Kostyuk, she talked about how like she actually felt it was better that she lost in the final of San Diego before going to Indian Wells, because she felt like if she had won it, she has felt that the like emotional like hangover of winning something can almost be detrimental, because then like you come in with less motivation into your next tournament. But whereas when she lost, it wasn't such a shattering defeat. She felt like, okay, I still have more room to improve. She makes the semifinals of Indian Wells, loses the semifinals of Indian Wells, comes to Stuttgart, now makes the final. Sounds like maybe she probably should like not try too hard to win this final if she has any hopes of winning Roland Garros. Maybe she wants to save the peak. She doesn't want
or maybe though, maybe in this instance, there's a long enough runway, a full month between the end of this event and the start of the next one, that it's because like the direct transition, actually, that does make sense to me. I mean, we saw Bolter lose round one after winning San Diego. So like literally that was the point she was trying to make. Can I ask? I know we try not to I try not to nerd out with you too much, but I actually, people don't talk enough. You have a very good eye for tennis. Like you do really, I really appreciate your tactical breakdowns every time. That's why I always ask you back on the show. And so I'm going to ask you to get tactical with me here. What do you think she's better at? Like, I know that's such a, like a simple question, but I actually am curious, like as you've watched her this year, do you see a tangible difference?
Okay. The thing about Kostyuk, and I think we might have had this conversation before, is I feel like that Kostyuk is the player that people thought Bencic was. Like, she can hit every shot in tennis, and she's, you know, can absorb the pace. But I feel like Kostyuk's technique is so much cleaner, whereas Bencic's is a bit more overwrought at times and a bit more mechanical. And I think she's in really phenomenal shape. I mean, it was a little bit of a flex when she was telling the story about her wedding dress, that like she was so determined not to gain weight for her wedding that she actually lost too much weight. And she was like, the dress came in China and it was too big. And I was like, Marta, no, what did you do? And she was like, I had to get it fixed. I was like, oh, Marta, you're crazy. So I feel like she's in much better shape than she's been in a while and is just more emotionally mature. She's handling the ups and downs. I mean, come on, like saving 5 match points against Zheng Qinwen, losing 7 match points against Coco before finally converting her 8th. I mean, this is, I feel like we ride the wave with Marta over the years. I feel like she's finally riding the wave herself and, you know, having moments where, oh my God, how did I hit that shot, to, you know what, the next point's going to be better. I have all of the arsenal to make the next point better than the last. And I think perhaps that is, you know, and she also has a really strong support system right now. Sandra Zinevska is a coach, you know, having that separation perhaps from her mother, who had been her primary coach for a long time, or primary source of, you know, of comfort and inspiration, to have another voice on the team to kind of ground things out, I think has been helpful. But no, I think when you look at her, in many ways, she looks like the same kid from 2018, you know, just better.
I couldn't agree with you more. Like, that's why I wanted to ask. Because, first of all, against Coco, just Coco alone this season, she saved 20 of 37 break points she faced in those two matches. 20 of 37.
It's still like, a goose.
This week, first three matches, she faced 41 total break points through three matches. By the way, her straight set win over Von Drosova today was her first straight set victory of the tournament, DK.
Like, iconic.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I hate this because I like to point to a stat or say, like, actually, the way she steps around the inside forehand right
now. I know, I thought it was a trick question. I think you'd be like, actually, you haven't noticed her backhand?
No. It's just like, that's the thing to me, and that's what makes this feel so real, is it doesn't feel out of her comfort level. It just feels like a player where everything, the stars have finally aligned, where it's just like, you know what? I'm done screwing around. You know what? Let's win. You know, she still doesn't win at 40-15. I was going to say, let's take care of the points we need to take care of. There still is that dose of drama mixed in, but it's okay. It's add out. I need to make 30 balls on this rally. I can't go for the flashy drop shot or the short angle backhand or try to slap a forehand inside in, get behind it. I'm not doing that in this one. I am more athletic than you. I dare you to beat me. And look, again, like that she found this gear at 21, that's the scary part. Because it feels like the runway could be at least a half decade. It does feel like this level, which she showed flashes of so thoroughly in her first, was only 5 years, but felt like 25 years of professional tennis. Like, you're so right. That's why I wanted to ask you, because I wanted to see if you saw something different. I agree. It's like, this is what we always saw. It's just finally you see it from start to finish in the match. And by the way, the best part for fans at home, she still gives you the drama. She still gives you 20 break points or 15 against Coco, like whatever it may be, it feels sustainable. Like, I just don't see her going away. And as you start to, again, make like the tiers of the power rankings moving forward, we should do next gen tiers pod where we do tiers here. Shout out to I Was Right, You Were Wrong group chat, DK, where S tiers have been a big conversation topic of late. Do I have her elevated to tier one prospect where I'm like, I think she wins a slam in the next decade? Lock it in. Not quite there. Whatever the tier right below that is, though, that's where she now occupies. It's like she's just a tier two player moving forward, where she should be competing to make tour finals every season. I should see her in the quarterfinals of Grand Slams getting shots against the big dogs, because if you don't have the consistency, the athleticism, or a weapon to throw her off, she can just do too many things to throw at you to make you uncomfortable. And that's my big thing. It feels very real and very sustainable.
It's funny because on one hand, it still doesn't to me, but yeah, at the same time, Vondrousova won Wimbledon last year. I mean, like someone who plays like, an unorthodox game, someone who could do a lot of different things. I mean, I think maybe the difference between Vondrousova and Kostyuk still is that I feel like Vondrousova is just still a calmer character on court and was able to really ride the wave of a lot more of the ocean that she was with on the other side of the net. And I do think there's something to be said about, listen, how much sooner would we have seen this from Marta had she not had to, shoulder the emotional weight of what's been going on at home for the last 2 years? I mean, this is someone who's been like, as we've said, it's been on tour for a while, has seen younger players surpass her, a Coco Gauff chief among them, younger than her, already has won a slam. And I think, not that one ever gets over what's happening and what continues to happen, but I think that she is finally in a place where she's able to display her best tennis. And it's a shame in a way we haven't gotten to see it sooner. But I think also to your point, she is physically set up to do this for a very long time. There's nothing about her game you think, uh-oh, this is not sustainable. This is portentous of a future injury. As long as she stays healthy and happy, I do think we're going to see a lot of consistency from her over the next couple of years.
I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, that's a really fun final. Kostyuk versus Rybakina. Fun contrast. Again, you've got the...
She's a showman.
You've got the unstoppable force versus the immovable object. Like, again, sneakily, Rybakina 2 right now in the points race. Kostyuk 7th in the points race. So ostensibly 2 top 8 players so far this season competing in our first significant... Well, Charleston is actually sneaky significant given the density of that field. But in our first significant European clay court event, I would say, of this swing. DK, I want to rapid fire through some other Stuttgart takes here quickly. We're just going to go through all the names. You give me the reaction. Again, we'll do it quick, I promise, because we got other things to cover here, and we're on a bit of a...
That is the trouble with Stuttgart. It's like every match matters. Like, you look at the order of play, you're like, well, I simply must cover this, and I simply must cover that. Before you know it, you're working a 12-hour day. No
and offense. I think I let an F-bomb slip in further, and I apologize for that. I'll make sure Westhoff gets the quack here. The draw was crazy. It was unbelievable draw, DK.
Underdome. Just
like, give me all the first-round matchups. Like, we're not going to talk about Kudermetova's 5-7, 6-4, 6-4 win over Krejcikova. We could.
Like, want to.
I so badly. Like, I mean, we haven't gotten to have a Barbora discussion in a little bit. We're not going to do on 7-6 in the third over Alexandrova either, but yeah, we could. Vondrousova over Vekic, we could. Bedosa over Schneider, I will at some point. No, let's go in descending order here. Vondrousova, you back with her? Like, was this all you needed to see, or you still got some questions?
No, I feel good about her. She's just like, I always think of that image macro of her from 2019 Roland Garros, just the smirk. I just feel like the smirk is back. That volley that she stabbed at 5-all to break it, Sabalenka and serve out that match. I kind of thought she had this title in the bag in a way. Like, it just felt like she would
ooky spooky her way to the title, but I think still like a good start for her, has a long runway and is a former French Open finalist. You know, as much as we talk about Wimbledon, this is a huge opportunity for her to gain a lot of points and pad that ranking. Cause you know, obviously she's defending a lot in a month at Wimbledon, but you know, from feeling like maybe she was fading away, maybe she was, you know, going to be gone for a while, perhaps. Like, I don't know. All of a sudden, like we weren't seeing her in draws. Like, mm-hmm. seems like back and better than ever. And again, someone who also doesn't really understand why she did what she did on grass when she knows how capable she is on clay. So I think in that way, it'll kind of keep her motivated to play well over the next couple of weeks.
I have one word, health. When she's healthy, she's top eight player in the world. I've been very clear about that for 18 months.
Well, Mukova set a very low bar. So all she needs to do is, you know, show up.
Amen. Iga. Do you care that she lost?
I mean, she had a lot of break points, which was weird. Sure. Like, that was like, it was a weird match, like, to look at the point by points. But, you know, I don't know if she, you know, I think there was a lot made of her undefeated streak at Stuttgart. I don't know if she really reads into it that much, which is the most important thing. And she's got, you know, more.
Sabalenka could have done this to her last year in the final.
Sure.
Like, that, it was just like, I agree. That winless or that undefeated streak is useless.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this is, Stuttgart is such a different tournament from the other clay court warmups. I mean, it is part of what makes the clay court swing a little strange, that you're playing indoors at altitude, you finally get to Rome, and then you get to Rome. Like, it's, you don't really get the same, like, runway of a consistent conditions that you were used to warming up for Australia or for even Wimbledon or the US Open. So that always makes it a little kooky, but otherwise, played strong against Mertens, you know, played a really good Raducanu in the quarters, you know, and you know, loses to Rybakina. Oh, well, you know, if you give her three more chances to win this match, maybe at least one or two times out of the next three, I would give her to win this one. So I think it's certainly still Iga right now, all the way.
And the best part is now she gets to respond. Like, that's my favorite part about an early season Iga loss, is now it's like, oh, you thought, no. And
the most tenacious player on tour.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best part. It's my favorite, again, one of my favorite things to see.
We love her.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Raducanu. I have been saying this since I saw her in Auckland, DK. You know it, because I've been chirping it at you more than anyone. She's back. Like, this is the best she's played since the U.S. Open.
Phenomenal. Like, really, really good. Like, obviously, she had her chance for that 2-0 lead, and who knows what happens. But, I mean, I remember people got really mad at me when I suggested that Emma had a chance against Iga last year, I think, and maybe Indian Wells, and obviously Iga won really easily. But like, when Emma can play as well as we've seen her play to win the US Open, you know, it wasn't a totally straightforward match. And sure enough, it was 2 hours and it felt close the whole way, even though Iga had her nose in front for all of the second set. It just felt like, well, you know, Emma's playing really well. And it's one of those matches that I think is going to give her, if she could stay healthy, it'll give her some confidence over the next couple of weeks. So hopefully, you know, the British press and everybody else doesn't blow it too far out of proportion. It was still, you know, a straight set loss in a quarterfinals of a 500. That's like a crazy, but you know, for someone who's been so injured and so unlucky over the years, you know, it's, you want to see somebody back up that big result that she had a little bit. And so I think this is a good chance for her to do it if she could stay healthy for the next couple of weeks.
Never been more impressed in my life by a 9-6 start to a season. Like, she's just playing top 25 tennis again. And I just, there was a moment like in 2022 when all the wandering was happening. You're like, God, are we going to get here again for another half decade? And then more injuries started to pile up. But it's just so encouraging to see, like, no. That underlying talent was real. She is one hell of a ball striker. And, you know, some people like the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe. Here on this show, we like MCE, main character energy. She certainly brings that. Is Pauline, like, at what point do we have to have a mea culpa and be like, okay, Pauline is a top 15 player? Like, it still hasn't sunk in.
I thought we were going to have to when I thought she was going to beat Rybakina. I was like, here it is. Here's the Rybakina story. Here's the Jasmine Paolini story. Because I feel like we have not really covered it. And we try to put it off.
You and I try to put it off every episode where it's like we kind of dip the toe in it. But then we're like, let's go back to the top three.
I actively put it off in Indian Wells where I did this long sit down with Potapova and then realized she was going to play Paolini. And I was like, this is so bad, David. You should have probably spoken to Jasmine Paolini because she's probably going to win this match. And then Potapova did win, so I did feel a little bit justified in the end. But, like, it does – I mean, and it seems like she can play on all surfaces. Like, I don't really see this slowing down necessarily. She's so confident. She's got a lot of momentum. You know, again, she lost to Rybakina playing really great tennis. Oh, well. Like, I don't really think that this is going to derail her. You know, the fact that she won that title in Dubai, phenomenal stuff. Good for her. Is she a future Grand Slam finalist? Probably not. Is she a future Grand Slam semifinalist? Yeah, possibly. It would not shock me.
Probably not.
I mean, it
it's going to, I mean, I feel like she's going to end up in a quarterfinal, you know, in the next 6 months.
Yeah, that I'd agree with.
50-50 shot of her. I mean, she could play whoever in the quarters, and then who knows? You know, yes, she could play Rybakina, and she could play not Rybakina in the quarters, and then she'll be the favorite to win that one.
Yeah. 1-0 over Irani in the first round sounds irrelevant, but that's like what a good player does, to just be like, I'm going to kill you today.
A real passing of the torch moment to Pallini, his partners.
Do we owe Alex McPherson? Is he the one who wrote the Italian women's
her number one fan.
Do we owe him an apology?
The full back catalog of Pallini content I would owe to Alex McPherson.
Yeah, exactly.
So, shout out to him. It's been a very good 6 months for him.
All right, last two here. Coco Sabalenka. I mean, they each lost 7-6, 7-5 in the third, respectively. Like, the Sabalenka, did she look better than she did in Miami? Kind of, but, like, it was still obviously a little erratic. I mean, for Coco, like, I don't think 7-6 in the third to Kostyuk's a bad loss, but given the context of how that match played off, it certainly wasn't an impressive loss.
She lost to Vickery.
Yeah, Dainu, as they say in my culture. What do you do with those top three seeds knocked out in the quarterfinals?
I mean, all right. I think the Sabalenka situation is obviously, there's a lot going on. You know, emotionally, we can't speak to what she's been through over the last month and a half. And then also just surfacely speaking, I still think that clay will be the toughest surface for Sabalenka to win on relative to the rest, because I think the conditions were quite slow, again, in Stuttgart. And I think you saw that frustration play out for Sabalenka against Von Drusova, just going for too much, you know, and looking to really end the point, not being able to do it. When she was dialed in, she played great. You know, the streak she went on to win the first set against Von Drusova, I was like, oh, she's got this. Like, wow. So I do think if she finds that vein of form, she could do a lot of damage over the next couple of weeks. But I still think that that's tougher to find on the surface for her. And for Coco Gauff, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just think, you know, this is a very violent shift in perception, perhaps, because we went, you know, we really talk about riding the wave. You know, we felt like, you know, she's stagnating, she's regressing, she's improving, she's better than she ever was. And maybe she's regressing a little bit, or, you know, returning back to the mean. You know, I think it's really phenomenal that she won the US Open. You know, I think she played really the best tennis of her life, you know, played within herself, played, you know, channeled the crowd, did some really great stuff to win it. I think it's hard to expect that of her again so soon. You know, I think that because I think ultimately what we're seeing is that she didn't necessarily fix the elements of her game completely to win that title. She played the best tennis she could possibly play to win it, but that's hard to find when you're dealing with a really, you know, pretty big technical deficiency still in that forehand. And until that forehand is fixed, she dips into a vein of confidence that allows her to really hit through it and not feel pulled back. I think that that's going to be hard to assume that she is a lock for the deeper rounds of these tournaments. And I mean, that said, she still has played pretty well, you know, lost to Sakari, lost to Kostyuk, but it just, I think that maybe we were coming in thinking this is a totally different Coco, and maybe it's just a slightly better Coco. And that's good. That's great, but it's not tier one.
I mentioned Raducanu's the most impressive 9-6 I think I've ever seen. Coco's is the least inspiring. I didn't say unimpressive, but it's the least inspiring 19-6 I've ever seen. Like, to her credit, Coco Gauff has beaten everyone she is supposed to beat this season. If you are a lower-ranked player, I guess everyone's lower-ranked, so that's not exactly right. But if you're not on her tier relative to where we are on the calendar, you're not beating her. Like, Kalinskaya in Dubai was kind of on the tier and did end up beating her, even still beat it in three sets, but, like, that was the quality of opponent it needed. Sabalenka obviously beats her in Australia. Garcia serving lights out in Miami. Sakari, the funkiness of that match in Indian Wells. But again, like, that she didn't play well, winning ugly to get there, the Brad Gilbert effect in full fully apparent, excuse me. It just depends what your expectations are for Coco Gauff. If you think that the best version of her, the real version of her, is the version we saw at the U.S. Open, then I think you have to be disappointed by her start to this season, because she has not been at that level. If your context for Coco Gauff is this is still someone who is 20 years old and is still on the ascent in her career and is still trying to consolidate her place at the top of the game, B to B plus in terms of what we've seen so far. Like, nothing disqualifying, nothing to generate serious concern, but nothing inspiring either. Like, it's just been a relatively status quo season for Goff.
In a way, it's kind of where she was this time last year, where she was beating everyone she was supposed to beat. It's just that the list of players she's supposed to beat has gotten longer, and she's
held up to that bargain
for the most part.
Yeah, so. that's really well. I couldn't agree with you more. That list has just gotten longer, and to her credit, she still beats those names. It's just a longer list now than it once was. Those were your quarterfinalists in Stuttgart. By the way, I didn't mention anything much there on the Sabalenka front. I agree. Like, I just don't know how seriously to take this Sabalenka, because I'm like, just wait till she's locked for a major where she's made the semifinals or further at the last six. Like, she has earned that benefit of the doubt in a way only Iga and the women's game
and
really
I think
has.
Her style of tennis makes it. I mean, exactly. for her to be putting down Świątek levels of consistency for 52 weeks a year was always unrealistic. And so the fact that she was doing it for as long as she did last year always felt like, wow, I mean, when is the tire going to blow out on this car? Like, it just felt like unsustainable. So the fact that she is not delivering semis, finals every week is okay, but she's still the most recent Grand Slam champion. So, you know, we can reevaluate in another 3 months after Wimbledon.
Yeah, well said. All right, last but not least, DK, before I let you go, and I thought we were going to have more time to do this, but I needed to take a deep dive in Stuttgart. I needed that therapeutically. You actually just made my day, so thank you very much. Made my week.
You don't want to talk about the line calls in Monte Carlo?
No, I do want to talk about Monte Carlo. And I actually, again, listeners, here's a little sneak peek. I'm bringing DK back on the show next week when I will be fully removed from the Stillwater environment and be able to fully focus on all.
He's coming to you live from his suite, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. I want you to know I showed DK probably more chest than he wanted to see here this morning. He got to see, I always call, you know, when someone has chest hair significant, like right over their heart. Like, I always say I call it the bat signal. Like, when it gets really bad, you've got a bat signal on your chest. I didn't quite have a bat signal. Like, that's the one part of my body where I don't grow that much hair. But DK got the lobes of the top half of the bat when he came onto the Zoom. And so
you had to tell me, David, my eyebrows are up here.
Yeah. Exactly. That's all I was trying to say. Anyways, I do want to talk one topic as it relates to Monte Carlo. And the topic is obvious. Alex Diemenauer. Come on. You like
it.
Yeah, you didn't laugh into the mic, which makes me upset. But we'll save that for a different time. Yeah. Let's just have the question. How real is the Tsitsipas run? Obviously, no one in the tennis world needed that more than him. A man whose arrow was pointing strictly downwards, on the decline. No one was making the case for Stefanos coming into Monte Carlo.
It wasn't even an arrow anymore. It was just flames.
Zverev, Khachanov, Sinner, Ruud. That's as impressive of a four-win run accomplished by anyone not named Jannik Sinner this season. The backhand, eye test-wise, it was just different. You know, as the kids say, it hit differently during that week-long run in Monte Carlo. The depth, the action. I think he moves to his forehand on clay maybe better than anyone in the men's game right now. It's just, if he gets a look at a forehand, the weight of that shot on this surface, his opponents are just in serious trouble, DK. And so I ask you, to what degree and in what ways, if at all, did that Monte Carlo run change your current perception of Tsitsipas?
I mean, look, no one has been tougher on Tsitsipas, I think, than me. I've been shrugging it off. Like,
100%.
But even when he made the Australian Open final last year, it was like, meh, whatever. You know, like, let's back it up. But listen, I think for me, for Tsitsipas, it starts with the tweets. The fact that the tweets are back. The fact that he seems, like, very much in his, like, woo-woo, like, you know,
his element,
happy,
his groove.
You know, he seems happy. He has seemed very unhappy basically since Roland Garros 2021. Like, I feel like it's, even though he's, you know, he made that second semifinal, he's won a master since then. Like, I don't think he has been happy. And, you know, also dealing with the emotional up and downs of partner Paula Badosa's injury struggles. He seemed very weighed down by that in Indian Wells. You know, Paula has, you know, Stuttgart retirement aside, has actually seemed a bit healthier over the last couple of weeks. That may be, you know, aiding in the increase in good vibes within Team Tsitsipas or Team Tsitsidosa. And so I think it starts there. I think he is one of those momentum vibes players, and the vibes are good right now. Now, whether that can translate to a slam, Maybe. I mean, look, I mean, you would, if you were to list the top, the people most likely to win Roland Garros, you would look at, I guess, Jannik Sinner, number one. You would look at Alcaraz or Djokovic, both of whom have not been overly inspiring. Djokovic is not playing Madrid. It's possible Alcaraz might even not play Madrid based on his injury. That leaves a lot of space in that semifinal bracket. And a Jannik Sinner who's never won Roland Garros before versus, you know, an Alcaraz has won two slams or a Djokovic has won a bazillion. So I think all of a sudden things look a little bit more. You look at Tsitsipas, you look at Casper Ruud, you look at Holger Rune, maybe even look at you even look at a Grigor Dimitrov. You don't look at an Alex Diminhauer unless you're Gruskin. So I feel like maybe, you know, the all of a sudden the clay court swing for the men looks like you're eating triangle pizza that's cut out of a circle and put in a square box, to quote Stefanos Tsitsipas, a quote that I'm utterly confident he came up with himself.
Well, the vulnerable.
The torture. He is the tortured poet in the tortured poets department. End scene.
That's good. All right, well, should we just stop? Do I respond? Because that was really good.
The rest will be on Patreon.
Yeah. That's really well said. And again, yeah, like I talked about this today because shout out to Jason Goodall, Jeff Chisiver, Nick Monroe, Mike Haston, second serve shout today. But it's really such a fun show. And by the way,
the TC Mafia.
And the thing that's really fun is you get to the expo and it's very clear, like, Tracy and all the, like, how much they all love doing the show, because it's just like you get the chance to cook a little bit, and again, you're not as constrained by commercial breaks and whatever it may be. That's why it's a great show for me, because I say, give me one question, I can fill in 10, 15, an hour, you tell me what you need.
You're the Marta Kostyuk of T2.
No, second serve was just, they could call it Gruskin. Anyways, the point is, more broadly, as you look at where, wow, I lost my thread. That doesn't happen. I got it back. Don't worry. They asked, like, should Rafa be seated at Roland Garros this year? That's something they're asking all their guests. And I think that's a fun conversation to have. Should he be seated? I said no. Will he be seated? My answer to that question was yes, because, like, the idea of him drawing a floating seed in the first round, that is horrifying, I think, for the French Open. And, again, just out of tip of the cap respect, it's not like the loss to Diminhauer was horrible. Like, if he's healthy, I'm sure he's a top 32 clay court player in the world right now. So my answer is, do I think he's a seed? No. Do I think he will be one? Yes. The point is, he is not the threat coming into Roland Garros that he has been for two decades now. Djokovic is still Djokovic, and he's top tier right there with Sinner, with Alcaraz, with, well, not Medvedev, with Sinner, Alcaraz on this surface. But, like, they all have some lingering health issues, or they all have some, you know, again, to see a health issue slow Sinner down, up 4-1 in that third set against Monte Carlo. Remember, we're probably not talking about this if Sinner is healthy and able to close out that match as he looked so near to doing in Monte Carlo in that semifinal. But the physicality of clay, like, is his body ready to do that seven matches in a row on at Roland Garros? I need to see it before I believe
it. In six straight months, effectively.
Yeah, I think more than that. I would argue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, since last fall. Yeah, true.
Exactly. True. And so Alcaraz, like, I think he will be a monster on clay in the prime of his career. He just can't get healthy, it feels like, to start this 2024 season, put together a runway of six consecutive weeks of world number one tennis. And then Djokovic is still Djokovic, but he's not unbeatable Djokovic. He's a number one, like, he's world number one, but he's not Novak freaking Djokovic right now. And so, to your point perfectly, like, there's a window, and that window is open right now because Alcaraz and Sinner aren't at the peaks of their power. They're getting closer and closer with every day, but they're not there yet. If you're Tsitsipas, if you're Casper Ruud, who's holding over 90% of the time, if you're Sasha Zverev, who has not started out this clay court season well, but has built up that equity to be, I would say, a top five guy over the last 9 months, and certainly whenever he's been healthy, you feel like you can plug him into the quarterfinals or better of the French Open of late. The window's open. Like, if you're going to steal a slam, the 2024 French Open feels so stealable, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it just makes me think this is a very specific, very niche, very gay reference.
Are we about to go Real Housewives?
Close. Bravo.
Yes.
Project Runway, season one, 2004.
Yes.
Two models
Heidi?
Stand on the runway. No, she's waiting there. She's the host, and there's two models in their black slips, because that's what they do.
Yes.
This is 2004.
Yes.
And there's one model left, one button in the bag, the last designer. Karasan looks up at the two models between the one who wore the losing outfit in episode one. It's episode two, so very early in the process, and she just holds up her button with her name on it. She goes, Josiane, baby. Do the job, girl. And Josiane leaps into the air. She's a Brazilian and she's fiery. And that's how I feel about Casper and Stefanos. It's like, do the job, girl. Like, this is your time. Like, this could be your moment and your only moment. You know, next year might be way too late. Sinner might be like six slams deep, you know, by the time next Roland Garros rolls around. Alcaraz, Djokovic could be in another, like another tear. This is your moment. And if you don't do it, like, ouch. The tortured poet department will be overflowing.
I need a second. 2004.
You're welcome for that one.
That's really good.
That's so specific. One of those like little grains of pop culture like nonsense.
Ooh, that's really good.
Harrison, who went on to design the costumes for the Descendants movies for my straights in the audience.
2004, I turned 9 that year. So at 8, what was I watching? A lot of Toonami. Like, I feel like that was a Frieza season of Dragon Ball Z. So that's
that little robot man.
Yeah, in the little ship above everything.
Tom.
I feel like that was a Frieza season. What else was I doing in 2004? Good Michigan year, Chad Henne's freshman year, football quarterback. I know that's your thing. Yeah, I was not. Actually, you know, my mom at the beginning would watch some Project Runway, so I'm not unfamiliar with it. Let me ask you this.
They would marathon it, like, every day, every episode, but go on.
2004, is that the bachelor who was the fireman who actually, no, not the bachelor, the bachelorette, it might have been the first season of the bachelorette, who married the fireman, and it, like, actually worked. Like, they actually stayed married, which was, like, the first time it worked. That was right around 04, right?
I know there was, like, one bachelorette couple that like,
first one where it was like, oh, my God, it worked.
The Kelly Clarkson of bachelorette couple. Yeah.
It's a great cop.
That's a joke for everybody.
Whatever happened to Clay Aikman? Like, I thought he was going to make it.
Not Clay Aikman, although I've also been thinking of 2004 because that's the year that Fantasia Barrino, star of the Color Purple movie musical, beat Diana DeGarmo, who sang a song called Emotional, which has made me think of Holger Rune and Marta Kostyuk. But specifically Holger Rune, especially that tweet when he was like, if I want to cry, I can cry. And I'm like, sometimes I get emotional. Sometimes I do some stupid things.
Two broadcast jokes I've used to and get whether you approve of them or not.
Sure.
Okay. Whenever it's like a 5-1 or 5-2 lead-ish, you know, I always go, I hate to evoke the words of JoJo, but I think it's just too little too late. Like, that's a good one, right?
That is a good call. That's a 2006.
So again, we're right in the range.
Very good.
So again, sticking in that range, shout out to my sixth grade teacher, Miss Bianchi, who got us all easy buttons as our way of bringing our advisory together. So Isaac, no, DK, will you play it for us here real quick?
It's still broken.
And mine's broken too. That's so
it is. I probably should try to see if I can replace the battery, but there are no batteries in it. But let me see. I will deliver it to next episode.
That's so freaking funny.
So reach behind me, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't even have to move.
So Tyler Zink, love you, TZ, fifth year at Oklahoma State, came up to goes, hey, I was rewatching the broadcast or someone sent him a clip. Isaac Bacroft, his teammate, won in straight sets and played unbelievable yesterday. And I go, give him a Staples button. That was easy. That's a good one, right?
For the 18 to 49 demographic right now, yes, that is right.
What I'm
the sweet
saying.
Spot.
I'm calling college tennis. Like, that's the strike. You got to know. Like, look, if I was doing the Roland Garros semifinal, I'd probably keep that one in the back pocket. For Big 12
to think that the people who most laugh at that joke right now are probably watching that with their kids. Help!
I try to quote as much 2000s. I might have to work in somebody that you used to know into today's broadcast because, yeah, that's the good stuff.
The 2012.
Yeah, exactly. All that said, shout out to you, DK. I appreciate you joining me on such short notice as well. This was therapeutic. I needed to get this mini break off my chest. I had some thoughts that needed to get out immediately. And by the way, like, we haven't talked Barcelona, Munich, Bucharest, Nadal, really. Like, you
Snowden.
Know,
Snowden, yeah. Munich.
Sloan Stephens, still alive. Like, looked really good today against Caroline Garcia. That's the best I've seen her play in a really long time.
That's a throwback. A little sad. And Garcia having to slum it in Rouen.
That match could have been in 2018. Like, that's how well Sloan was playing. Yeah. It was really impressive stuff.
But in Stuttgart.
That's all I got for you here today. Yeah, it should have been in Stuttgart. That's funny.
Yeah, that's
any final thoughts? Any things you need to plug before we wrap?
No, just been doing a lot of, you know, excitable on the beat coverage of Stuttgart. And we also didn't even mention this. Garbini Muguruza announced a retirement this morning. Sad. Saw it coming,
what?
But sad. Oh my God. Am I breaking news on the mini break?
What?
She announced it. Yeah, she announced she did a whole press conference. She had a floral dress. She announced that she was retiring. Yeah.
What?
Not a former Sugar champion, so no cause to bring her up.
West off.
Podcast, but
that, if that's not a breaking news sound effect, I don't know what is. I asked, by the way, Hasten today. Sorry, last one, listeners. I promise. If that next time I enter the show, could he do boo 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 boo? Because I was like, that should be my entrance.
Again, another 18 to 49 demographic.
Yeah,
right in the gut.
I hate to tell you, I am in the 18 to 49. I saw a poll recently where it was 18 to 27 was the youth, and I have aged out of that recently. I was crushed.
That was good. That's interesting because I feel like it's usually 18 to 24, and then there's like 24 to 35. Like when you make that pivot, and you're like, oh no, there are only a few more years left of 24 to 35.
18 to 27 year olds, their thoughts on Israel. I was like, well, I would be in this poll because I have thoughts. But no, I'm not in the youth demographic, so they're not even sharing my segment. This isn't what my generation thinks.
You leave that Stranger Things twinks out of that.
Muguruza retired. I feel like our friendship was not found. I mean, it was founded on the Sabalenka beat, as everyone knows. But early on, we had a lot of Moog discussions.
Like, we did. You had high hopes for her heading into 2022 after she won the WTA Finals. And I said, not so fast.
We'll go full circle here. Is this Green Day what we had high hopes for the living?
That would be Fall Out Boy.
The Green Day, Fall Out Boy, and All American Rejects are all the same in my mind. They're the same, like you were introduced in 2005.
There was a Soul Cycle class a couple summers ago that kept playing like Dirty Little Secret, and I was like, this is right here.
I'll keep it
gives you hell. It was Gives You Hell.
I'll keep you my dirty little secret. All right, we'll leave that
there. Those are some intense secrets in that music video. Yeah. if you care to revisit it.
Is it Breaking Benjamin, Diary of Jane? I feel like is right in that era as well. Like, I think there's a lot. Anyway,
songs about Jane's addiction.
Exactly. He had a Jane issue. Can we leave that there? I think that's probably a good place to end.
It's a
shout
good
out
place.
To you. Yeah. A shout out, as always, to Westhoff. What sort of a job does he have?
Oh, he does a fuck up an edit. He's going to have to do a fucking Jupiter this one.
Day in, day out. Yeah. It's a shame none of you got to hear those last 5 minutes because that was really funny. No, of course, we'll leave that in. And again, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me, DK. This was much needed. And make sure you're reading DK, listeners, every day. Tennis.com, DKTNS on Twitter. You can find all of his work. With that said, a shout out to you. Shout out to our friends at Tennis Point as well. Tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15 for the fantastic David Kane, our super producer Daniel Westhoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Crack Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. DK, what do we tell our listeners?
And that's the break.
So then do I get to say Dos Vidania this time?
Dos Vidania, yeah.